From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we preview Governor Snyder's fourth trade mission to China.
People don't realize, but the governor clearly does, that doing business in China is not an economic one-night stand.
69 years ago today, President Harry Truman launched a push for a national health care program. We see why it failed.
Truman said it was one of the bitterest disappointments of his presidency.
Ypsilanti singer-songwriter Matt Jones talks about his newest release.
Hopefully the album conveys what it sounds like when six, seven people playing together really actually love each other.
And we look at the do's and don'ts of talking about food as stateside goes tableside. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Governor Snyder travels to China today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Why he's going and what he's hoping to bring back. And this week is all about food. Today, policing the way we talk about what we're eating. That's as stateside goes tableside. But first, more money for roads being debated again in Lansing. But my next guest says don't just think about fixing roads and bridges. He hopes to make sure there's money for mass transit as well, reliable buses and rail lines. Chris Kolb is president of the Michigan Environmental Council. Chris, right now there's a lot of talk about the more than $1 billion a year needed to fix the state's roads and bridges, but not as much talk about how much money is needed for what you hope to see, improvements in mass transit. How much money would you like to see committed?
Well, this is about getting more money for our complete transportation system. So if you hear the governor talk, he does say that. He says we need money for our complete transportation system. And obviously people's focus is on our crumbling roads with the potholes, our bridges that are deteriorating. And we have a structural deficit, and we know that. But a portion of our transportation dollars also goes into several other funds. The one for us that's very important is a comprehensive transportation fund. And that funds our public transportation. It gives money to both passenger and freight rail as well. And it helps us build out a complete transportation system that's more of a 21st century transportation system. And it's one that if Michigan is going to attract and retain talent here in Michigan, we need to make adequate investment in. And so that's where we're just making sure that people understand if you put the money through the complete Act 51 funding formula, we'll be satisfied.
But we don't know that that's going to happen yet, right? Because everything is very fluid. The Senate will probably be tweaking it. The House has yet to vote on what they see as more money for transportation.
Yes, and the Senate did just pass a package that, you know, when it's fully implemented, we'll bring in about $1.5 billion a year into the system, and they are putting it through the entire funding formula. So we're very happy and supportive of that plan. We now are working on the House and making sure that they stay on that program, that we get money that's needed for the transportation system, but we also put it through the entire funding formula.
When you say funding formula, what does that mean? How much of that billion something will be sent to
the CTF right now is what we call the in political wonk talk, the Comprehensive Transportation Fund gets about 8.6% of the money. So it's a smaller portion, but it goes really into our communities and helps us to really build out our transportation system. And we focus on really two groups maybe that are important. One are the millennials, the young adults who really put an emphasis on public transportation. 66% of them, two-thirds, say that when they are considering a community to live in their top three criteria, access to public transportation is highly important to them. Second, they also say that 50% of them would move to another community with better public transit. So that's huge. If we are really, if talent and talent attraction is really the key to economic development in the future, that's key for us. The other population are seniors. Seniors want to have the ability to move around their community as well. From 2001 to 2009, we saw a 40% increase in seniors, those who are 65 and older, using our transit systems. In some communities, like up in Hancock in the UP, 83% of their passengers are seniors. Other parts of The northern Michigan, it's up to 30% are seniors. So that's another population that's really important. And what do people do when they ride transit? They go to work. They go to school. They go to the doctor. They go to the store. They go to see their friends and family. So it's a very important aspect of our transportation system.
Now, the last time that we saw an overhaul in the way that transportation funding was generated was 1997. And you say Michigan's public transit system missed out in a big way.
Yeah, we did. At that point, one, they should have done a higher increase in fuel tax, but they didn't. They did a 4-cent increase. And they put it through just to roads and bridges. And every year since then, the public transit agencies have lost out on $15 million a year. And that comes out to over the last, 19 years, over $200 million have been lost to public transit. And many of them are in financial, trouble as well. And so we need to make sure we keep them on good financial footing, providing the services that people want and need. And it helps make Michigan more attractive to talent. Let's look at just what happened down in Cleveland. When you look at their bus rapid transit they put on Euclid Avenue, it's called the healthcare line. They have seen, since they were just put that in, they have seen over $6 billion of economic development. I mean, that's the type of return on investment you see when you put your money into a 21st century transportation system.
Well, let's look, circle back to Lansing. And as we've seen all this year and even beyond, lawmakers can barely muster the will to decide how to fix the roads as they are. And granted, we know the state Senate already passed something and we're not sure what the House is going to be doing. How much will is there in Lansing, do you think, to do what it is you're asking for?
I think as long as we tell them, put the money through the full Act 51 funding formula, which is traditionally how we do things in Michigan. It's a well-thought-out plan. I mean, the people might want to tweak it here and there, but if we keep to that formula, we're fine. And I think that they will do that.
Chris, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Chris Kolb is president of the Michigan Environmental Council. A good meal can become a great meal if the restaurant has the right ambiance. That's what chefs say, at least. Good music, for instance, can improve the experience. Well, how about the other way around? Can good food improve the experience of listening to good music? Interlaken Public Radio's David Castleman has this story about a conductor and a chef who are teaming up in Traverse City to find out.
Matthew Schlomer conducts the Interlaken Arts Academy Band. Part of his job is picking what music the band will play for each concert. He says he's like a chef selecting a restaurant's menu.
If all the pieces in a concert are like a dessert, it doesn't work.
Schlomer has the music all picked out for the Interlaken Band's concert on November 20th. That concert is special because the audience will be served an 8-course meal to go along with the music. The meal's being prepared by the head chef at Black Star Farms in Leelanau County. It's something extra that Schlomer thinks can help the audience better engage with the music.
I'm always looking for ways that can help audiences experience music in different ways for a deeper understanding.
Come on in and we'll just kind of fill in right here. I feel like I'm at a zoo right now. I'm like, here's our chef. He's really wild. We keep him back here so that nobody gets too scared about what's going
on. In his natural environment.
Yes.
20 or so students from the Interlaken Band went to visit John Dayton at Black Star Farms. Dayton says the first thing he thought of when he listened to some of the concert's music was not the taste, but how the food would actually look on the plate.
You know, we listened to some music that was very raw and harsh in a way, and I was thinking of serving food on a piece of wood or a rock or a piece of marble.
Dayton says he's still not entirely sure what will be on the menu, even though the event is coming up soon. That's because his kitchen relies almost entirely on local food.
We do all our menu writing and food preparation based on the seasonality, so we want everything to be as fresh as possible. So sometimes you don't really know what is available until it is that day. It's that fresh here, so.
We don't have as many animals here as we normally do.
That's Stephanie Watala giving a tour of the farm. They produce a lot of the food they cook at Black Star.
The pigs and lambs are already gone to harvest this year and are in our freezer now. And actually will probably be used for part of the dinner on next Thursday.
Alan Brown is an audience researcher. He says there's a lot of collaboration between artists happening around the country.
Interdisciplinary arts programming is really the wave of the future. There's a lot of energy, artistic energy, and interest amongst audiences in art that breaks down boundaries, that transcends.
Brown's never heard of an event quite like this. He thinks the difficulty is that either the music or the food could overpower the other.
People need opportunities for focused listening. So I think it's important how they organize the program and allow people to alternatively focus on the food and the music.
At Interlaken, conductor Matthew Schlomer is going through the music with the band about a week out from the concert. Some of the music is well known, like a piece by Mozart. Some of the music is more obscure, like something called Scherzo for a Bitter Moon. He says the kids think it's a really weird piece.
They've been asking, I can't imagine what food is going to go with Scherzo for a Bitter Moon. You know, what is that going to be?
The sold-out dinner is Thursday at the Grand Traverse Commons Kirkbride Hall.
Interlaken Public Radio's David Castleman reporting for Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Matt Jones is a singer-songwriter from Ypsilanti, and he's also a big Civil War nerd.
I mean, I got a tattoo on my arm of Gettysburg just so people would ask me what it was, so I could be like, well, let me tell you, you know, for the next 3 hours.
The Civil War inspired many of the songs on Matt's latest album. It's called The Deep Enders.
Hopefully the album conveys what it sounds like when 6-7 people playing together really actually love each other. That's something you can't find. And I hope I can just implant a little bit of that in a listener.
Stateside's Emily Fox has more.
The first track off this album is mostly instrumental, and the only lyrics come at the very end, and they are simply, "Come love, I'll try to be ready, I will be waiting for you." And I understand those words come from a letter written in the Civil War, and you use the instrumentation to kind of invoke the mood of that letter.
Yeah. It was a letter from a man named Sullivan Ballou from Rhode Island who went down to Virginia. And shortly before the first Battle of Bull Run in 1861, he wrote his wife a letter saying, really, just saying that if he didn't come back, he would always be with her. And you read a lot of Civil War correspondence, and a lot of it is just way overhyped, at least by our standards today. It's also really cool to think, God, it would be really nice if we still talked like that, if we actually put some time into it. But it's just a beautiful letter. And actually, he never sent it. They found it in his trunk a week after he was killed at the Battle of Bull Run. So yeah, that was her, kind of her response to him. And I didn't know any other way than to do that instrumentally.
Like your song called The Darkest Things, and when I first heard it, the music and some of the lyrics sounded like you were telling a folk tale or maybe a fairy tale in some sense. But then I understand that this song kind of drifts away from your Civil War theme and is a little bit of a reflection on your life. Tell me more about this song.
The Darkest Things was the first song written for the album, and it really did allow me to write the rest of the songs on the album. Because when I started writing it, I was really, really just kind of bummed out about what was happening to me because I was not writing as much music. I wasn't playing as many shows. And I was working a job and not really sure what was going on. And I've always been kind of all or nothing. So when nothing's happening, I just assume nothing's going to happen. I'm done. And so I started writing a song about how I was done. And about halfway through, I was having so much fun doing it and having so much fun writing the lyrics and the melodies and everything that I was just like, you know, I'm not done. And so the song turns around halfway through, and by the end, I'm like off to my next album. So, and it's kind of like, I'm going to keep going, but things are always going to be this dark. And that's okay. It's one way to get through it.
On the trembling lips of age, 15 years have gone, I sing the same. While the words have slowed their rumbling, I'd prefer you for got my name. And let me walk alone, and let me swallow whole all the children whisper when they fall in love.
So we had you on Stateside around a year and a half ago, and during that interview you talked about issues you've had in recent years. You said you kind of got self-destructive for a while, and there was some alcohol abuse, and you got in a car accident as a result. In your latest album, The Deep Enders, you have a song called Hardly Marching. And this song kind of combines both the issues you have faced and you relate them back to this album's theme of the Civil War.
Yeah. Yeah. Hardly Marching is one of those last sort of, you know, unsteady, I'm out of control songs. It's hopefully I've said goodbye to that stuff. But yeah, I mean, it came out of me looking at myself, and it came out of me looking at General Ulysses S. Grant. So people love it when I come out with this stuff, when I tell them what songs are about. I'm being sarcastic. We both get a little nuts when we drink, and that. But at the same time, Grant felt a deep connection to his family, to his friends, that he would never sacrifice. And I know that he always felt a little sort of guilt, a little sense of guilt about having to put everybody else around him through things, just because he had a weakness. And that was what was behind Hardly Marching. I think, I don't know, maybe I try to relate too hard to these Civil War people, but what else am I going to do?
Forgotten how to say, no, hold my hand, you fire your brand, my bed of ice will cool ya, cast you.
You say that you think you've gotten past some of those issues. How were you able to get past issues of using alcohol too much?
You know, I quit drinking for a long time, and I realized during that time that I never did have a drinking problem. I definitely had a Matt Drones problem.
Which means
I didn't know how to deal with myself as who I am. I am crazily stressed all the time, and people can't tell. At least, you know, people say a lot like, oh, God, you seem so, like, low-key and you know, relaxed. And I'm like, well, good, I fooled you. And that's what I've been trying to do for a long time, is fool people. And so one really great way to fool people is by getting really drunk and acting like you don't care about anything. And then especially the effects of alcohol can really, you know, can be pretty convincing that you're not concerned with people's feelings. Like you don't care about what's going on in your own life. And that becomes a habit. The drinking becomes a habit, and pretending like you don't care about yourself, that becomes a habit. And that's the destructive thing. That's what I was hooked on, you know. Not letting people help out, not asking for help, and even though I needed it. But so once you figure that out, you don't need to drink as much. It just kind of – it's one thing leads to another. So I had a Matt problem, and I think I got over it because now I ask for help. I let people see me tearing my hair out, And they're, my friends are probably like, you know, I don't know which one I like better.
Yeah. Well, tell me about the songwriting process. What do you think you get your best songs out of when you're in that stage of, you know, that you went through where you're kind of struggling, or when your head is clear and you don't have a lot to worry about? When do you feel like you get your best songwriting
out? Oh, definitely now. Definitely now.
And why do you think that is?
Because when you're really losing it a little bit, when you're looking for crutches like booze or drugs, I mean, you can do those things, but all the time in the back of your mind is what's really going on. You're always thinking about how much you're screwing everything up. And you can't write a song like that. You can't make art like that. I can't make something really good and really genuine if the whole time I'm just thinking about how bad everything else is. There's no way. You know, like, I have to be as close to happy as I can be, whether or not that's really, really jumping for joy or just kind of still questioning things. As long as I don't have anything to feel guilty about, I can make good stuff. So, yeah, I've tried. I mean, I've made albums, I've written songs while I was losing my mind, and they might sound good, but when I listen to them, I can hear that and only that. And I don't hear that with this album. I hear myself going slow. So if I'm doing that, I know I'm doing something right.
I've been speaking with Ypsilanti's Matt Jones about his new album. It's called The Deep Enders. You can download his album at mattjones.bandcamp.com.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
This is Julia Child. Bon appetit.
Love that. Delicious.
Enjoy.
As Stateside goes tableside this week, let's talk about it. How we talk about food. Why do words like foodie, delish, and yummo drive some people crazy? Margot Finn is here. She's a lecturer at the University of Michigan. She specializes in food and popular culture. Very good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, it's funny. We spotted a piece on thekitchen.com. It was called 21 Food Words and Phrases That We Should All Probably Quit Using. I'm going to bounce a few of these off of you. And to get your opinion, thumbs up or thumbs down on these,
sure.
Za for pizza.
I don't know that I've ever actually heard somebody say that in earnestness. It's a great Scrabble word. It's very useful for Scrabble. It's funny to me that somebody would take offense to that. I don't have a problem with it. I also don't use it, though.
The writer said, don't insult your pizza. Yummo.
Yeah, so that's a Rachel Ray word. And I think Evo, if I remember it, is also on the list. I think that maybe what's happening there, Rachel Ray's an interesting figure. She's been quite successful. But particularly for, I think, a lot of people who want to see themselves as trendy or edgy, she's a threat. She's not cool, right? Mm-hmm. So to say, oh, I'm not going to use these words. Oh, yummo is gross. Oh, it's only stupid people say yummo. That's a way of pushing back against Rachel Ray, right? I like food, but I'm not lame like her.
That's interesting. Delish.
Right. So these abbreviations, some people just take real offense to that. Like, I think some people have similar problems with lol or other kind of new internet speak. It's just, there's something, maybe it's too cutesy for some people.
Yeah, and then I had to agree when I saw nom. They said we could be, you know, we're not 5 years old. Nom nom or noms.
See, that's really interesting to me because I think nom actually serves a purpose. I mean, I think they said something about nom's not very descriptive. Well, eat isn't very descriptive either, right? So, and there is a way that nom serves a different purpose. You know, somebody posts a picture of something on Facebook, for example, and you reply back in, you know, all caps nom. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is very succinctly, that looks like something I'd like to eat. And you couldn't just say eat and have it communicate that.
So
right?
That could be a good word. One of the phrases that they took umbrage with on this, thekitchen.com, was the party in your mouth, describing that.
Yeah, I think that's got to come from the Food Network, too. I'm not sure if that's a Guy Fieri or whose phrase that is. But I think that is kind of, again, somebody saying like, maybe this is, you know, an overused thing or a thing that's too pop culture and I'm cooler than that. I'm edgier than that. What I do is different.
And as we know, pop culture is shifting, so you can be very trendy and cool for calling your pizza Za 1 minute, and then the next week people are sneering at you for it because it sounds like you're trying too hard.
Absolutely. There's kind of a treadmill of these trends, right?
I'm talking with University of Michigan lecturer Margo Finn, who has really done a very cool job of combining her academic work in American culture with her love of food and wine. There was an interesting piece in The Atlantic by B.R. Myers that pretty much calls out foodies and gourmets, noting it's kind of always been a big part of the gourmet's pleasure that he eat in ways the mainstream cannot afford. Are foodies inherently obnoxious?
There's certainly a long history of anxiety about food snobbery, about elitism, and I think those concerns come from the fact that we can use food to perform status. So anytime there's that possibility of using some kind of culture to perform status, I think people are going to have to be very careful about distinguishing when they're doing that, when they're not. So just to know that that threat is there makes people know that what they're doing could be a kind of performance that might be crass or venal, a kind of class climbing. And so you'll always have that trend of people then making sure, you know, on the one hand, there's the great incentive to perform status. And on the other hand, there's the threat of being found out for, you know, performing status. It's a tight knot. Right?
It is a tight knot. And one can see it could certainly come off as a little too precious and too hip and privileged to be taking pictures of your awesome meal and maybe treating food as something of a holy experience rather than something we have to do to stay alive.
Right. Although, I mean, why can't it be both?
Yeah.
There's, you know, no reason that food should be excluded from the kinds of aesthetic experiences that it can offer. And yet, I think there's, you know, and that anxiety goes back a long time too, right? Is it wrong for us to elevate these bodily pleasures? Is there something perverse about celebrating things that are so lowly?
Margo Finn, University of Michigan lecturer who specializes in food and pop culture. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
Sometimes it's the persistent annoyance that leads to a great solution. In this case, the persistent annoyance was cleaning up sawdust, and it led to the creation of one of the most enduring made-in-Michigan brand names, Bissell. And if you've ever shampooed or vacuumed your carpet with a Bissell machine, you can thank sawdust back in 1876. Mark Bissell is CEO of the Grand Rapids-based company that bears his name. So tell us about Melville and Anna Bissell, your great-great-grandparents.
Interesting story. So this goes back to the 1870s, and Melville Bissell and his wife, Anna, owned a crockery shop. And in the unpacking of the merchandise, dust and whatnot would get in the air, and it would make a mess. And in those days, you had a corn broom, a feather duster, or a carpet beater for cleaning, and it was very simple. So Melville actually invented then the carpet sweeper, and it became an instant hit both in the U.S. and in fact, a number of countries overseas.
Well, in fact, if I understand correctly, the West Michigan-made carpet sweeper had a real royal fan in England's Queen Victoria?
That's right. She was one of the first customers, and we opened up a trading office in London in the late 1890s.
How long before Melville and Anna decided maybe crockery wasn't the way to go? Let's get into this business.
Right. Well, they had been making these with some helpers, you know, in the basement of their business for a few years, and then realized that this was really going to be a commercial success. And so then they opened up a factory in Grand Rapids and kind of moved out of the crockery business and into the floor cleaning business.
And when you stop and you think of that carpet sweeper and how revolutionary it was, and then the kind of products you can offer today in really a pretty short period of time.
Well, what's interesting to me is, you know, all the change that we're seeing from technology and globalization. So for 138 years, we're still in the cleaning business, and we're still making carpet sweepers. We make many other floor cleaning products, but the carpet sweeper has endured for all these years. We talk about life cycles, and it was such a great invention that it's passed the test of time.
Mark, thank you so much for sharing your family story with us.
Cindy, my pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Bissell is CEO of Bissell Incorporated. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder leaves for China today on his fourth trade mission to Asia. Tom Watkins has spent many years in many different roles campaigning for stronger ties between China and Michigan. Tom, what does the governor want to focus on for this fourth trade mission?
Well, the governor has a laser-like focus on two major objectives. One, to export our goods and services to the People's Republic of China. 1.3 billion people, or put another way, 1.3 billion new consumers of goods and services. Michigan has a lot of what the Chinese need and want. So it's exporting our goods and services, whether that's agricultural goods or automotive or technology, and the whole area of education as well, where we can work with the Chinese. The second piece is to attract foreign direct investment. The Asia Society has stated that Chinese will invest over $1 trillion around the world over the next decade. And the governor understands very clearly that Michigan is two beautiful peninsulas. We're not an island, and is working very, very hard and very smart in order to attract that direct investment here to create jobs and opportunity for the people of the state of Michigan.
Tom, can you give us some specifics as to what the governor has managed to accomplish from his previous three trips?
Well, there's been a number, particularly in the automobile industry, and a lot of this has to do with Brooks Patterson, the executive in Oakland County. In 2005, I encouraged the county executive, Brooks Patterson, to call for the teaching of Mandarin Chinese in all the schools. There's been a significant investment of Chinese auto companies. Believe it or not, and this is something that's hard for a lot of people to fathom, there's over 100 different car companies in China. It's the worldwide companies, so General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, Nissan, Toyota, Volkswagen, but also indigenous car companies that are in China, the Geely, which has purchased the Volvo company. And they are setting up a number of R&D centers, resource and development, here in the southeastern Michigan area. Also, the Chinese are populating our schools at the undergraduate and graduate level at Michigan State, University of Michigan, Wayne State, Western Michigan, Eastern, and the like. And so it's able to build those relationships, not just for the short term, but long term. Next year, automotive used to be the old Saginaw gear and steering if you're driving up north in Saginaw. It's now owned by a Chinese car company, and it's saved literally thousands of good, high-paying UAW jobs because of that Chinese investment. And people don't realize, but the governor clearly does, is that doing business in China is not an economic one-night stand. You can't just do one trip there. And so he has gone back, and his staff have been working to develop what the Chinese refer to as guanxi, or connections and relationships that will pay dividends for years to come.
How has the Detroit bankruptcy journey been viewed in China? Is it helping or hurting Michigan's cause?
Well, I think in the early phase, it gave a lot of people pause. But one of the great things that the governor is taking over on his trip is a success story, that Detroit is rising from the ashes. And just this past year, the Chinese have purchased two buildings in downtown Detroit, the old Free Press building and another one that's right beside it, where they can invest in those buildings to create jobs and opportunities here in the city of Detroit and the throw-off benefit for the region.
You reportedly suggested to Governor Snyder that he talk to the Chinese about getting some giant pandas for a Michigan zoo, I would presume the Detroit Zoo?
Well, quite honestly, the opportunity may be for the old Belle Isle Zoo, which could make, again, an economic magnet. But like all things that the governor is doing, he's pursuing this in a very methodical way. Does it make sense, first and foremost, on the ecology issue for the pandas? The pandas' views as a diplomatic prize from the Chinese, but here we are in the 36th year of the normalizing relationships with the People's Republic of China, and there's not a greater sign of friendship than having pandas. The nearest cities with pandas to Detroit are Toronto and Washington, D.C. The governor understands that they're certainly cute and huggable, and every parent and grandparent is going to bring their grandchild or child there, but it really becomes an economic magnet for the city of Detroit, whether it's at the Belle Isle Zoo or Detroit Zoo. But they're thoughtfully pursuing that as another opportunity to strengthen the relationship between Michigan and China.
I'd have to wonder, I would suspect from things I've read about these panda diplomacy, if you will, it's expensive. And what's your argument to those who say, why would a bankrupt city justify spending millions on pandas when we still need to restore and rebuild basic services?
I don't see it as the city investing. This is the kind of thing that's going to require people to step up and underwrite. But let's take a look here in Michigan and some of our major corporations. Amway Corporation, I would say 80 to 90% of their $13 billion profits come out of the People's Republic of China. Whirlpool, Dow, Ford, General Motors, Chrysler. We have major corporations that do business in China, and we'd certainly be tapping into those kind of relationships, and those are the kind of issues that are there. I would not expect there would be any contribution, if you will, at a municipal government in order to pay for this. This would have to be something that would pay for itself through those kind of arrangements. So there's a lot of work to do, both on the international scene and on the economic scenes to do it. But the governor likes to look at things on the long range and do things that are really going to pay dividends not only today but down the road.
You know, you and I have had this, talked about this in the past on Stateside, and I am always interested in your views that the fact that one of the inescapable truths of China is its human rights record. And why should Michigan strengthen ties with a government that is so repressive?
Well, I think that we certainly have to stand up for the values and the morals that make this country great. And I think that the president and Congress should address those issues of human rights. But the Chinese, 1.3 billion people, 500 million people that have raised up out of abject poverty into the middle class, they're going to be invested somewhere. Now, thoughtful, progressive leaders are saying, let's see that investment here to benefit the people and to put people back to work. Too oftentimes, the relationship with China is about division and subtraction, dividing people and pointing out problems and not looking for the addition and multiplication. I think that the governor is trying to find ways to make sure that China's rise doesn't come at our demise. And I think that's thoughtful and an appropriate way to pursue these issues.
Tom, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you, Cindy.
Tom Watkins is president and CEO of the Detroit Wayne County Health Authority, and he advises the state of Michigan on relations with China. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear yet another challenge to the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. This case, King versus Burwell, argues that because of the wording in a clause of the ACA, the people who get insurance through a federal exchange, not a state-run exchange, should not be entitled to tax credit subsidies. As this Obamacare battle continues, my next guest thinks it could be helpful to look back 69 years back to this exact day, November 19th in 1954. That's when new President Harry Truman spelled out a groundbreaking idea, a universal national health care program. Dr. Howard Markel, physician and medical historian from the University of Michigan, is here now. Exactly what did President Truman propose?
Well, it was remarkable. It was about 7 months into his presidency, which he inherited from the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and it was a five-point plan. He was very concerned that there weren't enough doctors and nurses and other health professionals in the rural districts of the United States, and that not a lot of health professionals wanted to practice out there because, A, they couldn't make a living, and, B, there weren't enough facilities, hospitals and so on, to practice their craft. So that was one thing he was concerned about, as well as the public health of the United States and improving vaccination rates, maternal child health, things like that, as well as really improving how the federal government invested in research. So everyone thinks about NIH. That's really a post-World War II phenomenon. I mean, it existed before, but the amount of billions of dollars that we put into medical research began after World War II. And then the real clincher is that he wanted every American to have access to a health insurance plan, as well as if they didn't work because of illness, they would get a check to subsidize their loss of income. And it was those last two that really stirred the pot.
And the pot, I can tell from what you've written, that it was really stirred by the AMA. The American Medical Association didn't like that fifth clause at all.
Not at all. They did not want what they called socialized medicine. And the American Medical Association then was extremely powerful. About 99% of all doctors in the United States belonged. Today, it's about 20% or less, and some of them are medical students. So they're not nearly the powerhouse they were back in the 40s or 50s. And they saw that their income, they felt that their income would be jeopardized. And, you know, money makes people do strange things. And the AMA came out in full force. They were extremely powerful. They had good connections. They were good with advertising and messaging. And they called it not only socialized medicine, but they called the Truman administration people with a direct party line to Moscow. So you had that fear of communism in the late 40s or early 50s that really carried a powerhouse.
And this was even 5 years before Senator Joe McCarthy and his infamous hearings.
Yeah, but since the Revolution, Americans were concerned about what was going on over there.
Well, and we were seeing things in the post-World War II era that certainly turned up the fires of alarm, shall we say. And President Truman went out of his way, didn't he, to say this is not socialized medicine.
He did. He said so in his speech. Mm-hmm. He was very careful to say that. And, you know, he sold it as an insurance plan. And Americans have been buying insurance for life insurance or accident insurance or what have you for some time. And you got what you paid into it. And it's really important to think about what health insurance was back in the 40s. There wasn't all that much medicine could do. So medicine didn't cost that much. In fact, health insurance benefits were given to UAW workers by the big three automakers because it was a benefit that didn't cost the big three all that much. Things, of course, have really changed now that it's almost one-fifth of our national expenses, of our GNP.
What was the public reception when President Truman first unveiled this idea 69 years ago?
Well, it did separate into – they didn't call them red and blue states back then, but it did separate based on your party affiliation. It was very exciting to two senators, Wagner and Murray, as well as Congressman John Dingell Sr. And they had a bill already that they pitched in 1943. FDR was a little bit busy with the war and did not give it that presidential heft that it needed. But they very quickly rewrote the bill. They called it the WMD bill. And it seemed very rosy because both the House and the Senate was Democratic. Mm-hmm. And it went through hearing after hearing, and then midterms happened in 1946. And just as the midterms recently the Democrats didn't fare too well. In fact, it was the first time since 1929 that the Republicans took over the House and the Senate. So that was pretty much the end of it for that session.
And then was there an attempt to breathe new life into it?
Yeah. In 1948, when Harry Truman ran for, you could say, election because he was never elected president.
And surprised everybody
and
by getting reelected.
Surprised everybody. Remember that famous picture of him holding up the newspaper, Dewey defeats Truman.
That's right.
And everybody has a copy of that newspaper, but I haven't seen too many of them. But anyway, he brought it up all during the campaign, and he really went after the AMA. And he was amazed that the AMA would call it communistic or anti-American. And he said it's the right thing to do. In fact, he said it was the Christian thing to do, to look after your fellow man and make sure that he or she had health insurance and a living wage when they became ill. So things looked a little bit better in 48. The Democrats did regain the House and the Senate, but again, hearing after hearing, and back came the AMA. And the AMA was very well practiced in this, but they also had the support of a lot of other big groups, including the American Bar Association and several other groups who really came to the foray to say this was socialized medicine, we don't want this. And as the 40s shifted into the 50s, there were many other factors. People were tired of paying taxes for the New Deal. People who had jobs, who were gainfully employed, were buying their own health insurance policies. As I mentioned, labor dropped out because not just UAW was successful at getting health benefits, but so were several other
unions
as well. And then there was the Korean War, and it sort of just faded away.
But boy, when you hear what was said and the lines of opposition, eerily similar to what
isn't
we're
it depressing?
Hearing.
Here we are 69 years later. Yeah, we haven't learned much. And Truman said it was one of the bitterest disappointments of his presidency. And, when Lyndon Johnson signed the Medicare-Medicaid Act of 1965, he did it in Independence, Missouri, with Bess and Harry Truman right there. And, in fact, they received the first Medicare cards, number one and number two. And LBJ said in his Texas drawl, Harry Truman, he's the real daddy of Medicare. And he was.
He was. What lessons do you think, Howard, we might take from this whole saga with President Truman's proposal that might be helpful in understanding where the nation is at with this division over the ACA?
Well, I think there's a great many mistruths and a great deal of rhetoric about what the ACA will or won't do, particularly in terms of threatening the welfare of the United States. I think when you really think about the fact that we're all going to get sick and it's all going to cost a great deal more than we probably have in our bank accounts, that an insurance policy where all of us participate, because that's how insurance works. If only some are involved and not others, it doesn't work very well. I think it's time that we really take a deep breath and think about how important it is for the health of the nation, not just the physical health, but the economic and social health, for all of us to have a good health insurance package that cares for us when we are ill.
Dr. Howard Markel, physician and medical historian with the University of Michigan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you're trudging outside to clear off the driveway or your car again, and you're looking at the falling snow and thinking, wait, is this not just mid-November? You have a lot of company. MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist Mark Torregrossa is here. Mark, is this it? Has winter settled in for the duration?
No, it hasn't. We're going to do almost an about face here at times in the next 10 days. And we're going to have some 40s. And actually, by Saturday or Sunday into Monday, we're going to have some rain and maybe a fairly sizable rain, half-inch rain.
Well, a lot of people are talking about hitting the road for Thanksgiving Day, and some of us, will be on the streets of downtown Detroit early thanks a turkey trot, and thousands of more will be on Woodward watching the big parade. Are we going to be battling snow and sub-zero wind chills, do you think? I know it's a little far out, but take a shot.
It is far out, and I'll be honest with you. Everything is all over the board right now because the weather pattern change in the hemisphere is just going crazy, and it typically does at this time of the year. But I will tell you that our best model that we look at out that far says quite a snowstorm could develop in the Great Lakes. Not sure exactly where just yet. And our second best model says a snow, but not a snowstorm. So I got to be honest with you. At this point right now, I got to stretch you along and still say we got to look at it early next week or at worst late this weekend, and I think the picture will become clearer.
Well, if all else fails, we can always say at least we aren't Buffalo.
That is a good point. You know, let's put it into perspective. 60 inches of snow in a couple of days, that would be Houghton Lake's entire season snowfall, and that would be almost double what Detroit would get in a normal winter.
MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist Mark Torregrossa. As always, thanks so much, Mark.
You're welcome.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Zach Dieterman, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.